clerk, please call the row.
Representative Berg. Senator Kaler. Representative Moffitt.
Here.
Senator Murphy. Representative Nekras. Representative Poe.
Here.
Representative Riley. Senator Rose.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Staines.
Yes.
Senator Severson.
Here.
Senator Trotter.
Here.
Representative Eunice.
Here.
Nine in attendance.
With nine in attendance, we have a quorum. I'm supposed to remind everyone that we're supposed to flip the switch when we have something to say. So, with nine members being present, we do have a quorum present. I want to welcome everyone down here on this beautiful 23rd of June day in Springfield. It's, the third day of summer. As I noticed coming down, I saw the corn is getting tall and all the other good things that Illinois has to offer is doing well. Hopefully, for the farmers' sake, we don't get too much rain because, as we know, farmers don't like no rain and they don't like too much rain. So hopefully that doesn't happen as we go forward. The good thing about being down here in June is it's called we have another opportunity not only to get together but to discuss some things that some business that we didn't get to discuss during the other part of the session. So today, primarily, we're going to be focusing on CMS and some of their contracts that have been let. On the April 14th, 2015 meeting, all aspects of the insurance program had not been finalized. Specifically, the bid for the pharmaceutical contract was still under review and a vendor had not been selected. It is our understanding that the bid process has now been completed and a contract awarded. We would like the department and the chief procurement officer to provide the commission with an update on the bid process as well as the contract award, and also update the commission on other aspects of the group insurance program that have occurred since our last meeting on the 14th. So if we could, we have the director of CMS, Ms. Terrell, and your team, if the CPO is here as well, can all come forward. You heard my opening remarks. Basically, can you sort of tell us where we are today following the actual letting of the contract?
Yes, sir. Let me just first introduce, I'm joined here today by the Chief Procurement Officer, who you all know for General Services, Matt Brown, and Pam Kogler is our Director for the Benefits Bureau, and Paul Serpa is our Director for the VEP program. I would like to let them respond to your specific questions, but as you stated in your opening, Chairman, the contract for prescription benefits management has been awarded. We have are in the process now of moving to the new vendor, which I believe July 1st is still the effective date, opening with a new vendor. I'll let Matt speak to the specifics of the procurement process, but it was a competitive process. We had multiple applicants. We believe that we did a good job in making a good business decision with respect to the awardee. It's a very complex process. As you know, the size of our operation is very significant. It's a significant cost item. And as you're also aware, we're all about trying to take cost out of the administrative processes so that we can allow those that revenue to be applied to programs that support the citizens of Illinois. So we're comfortable that is what happened in this case. And I'll let Matt speak to the rest. As far as the overall group health insurance program, we're still in negotiations with the with 34 different bargaining units, and that has obviously not yet concluded. The testimony that we provided previously relative to our target remains the same, is that we're trying to find a way to pull $700 million out of the group health insurance program and cost savings.
Okay. And what is your timeline on that?
I'm sorry?
What is your timeline on accomplishing that?
It's very much wedded to the resolution of the collective bargaining agreements, and obviously we would like to have everything done by the end of this week, and that's clearly not going to happen.
So we're acknowledging that it is a negotiated process,
mm-hmm.
that it is something that has to be done, so it is not just something arbitrarily that can be done.
Absolutely
going,
not.
Going forward. Okay, good. Thank you.
Sure. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Matt Brown. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the General Services Portfolio for the state. In your opening question, Mr. Chairman, you did ask about the status of how the procurements were conducted. In order to get to the place where we are today, there were two procurements that occurred. The first procurement was a procurement where all of the vendors were not qualified to proceed to evaluations. They required additional technical responsibilities to be met as a result of that activity. That procurement was canceled, requiring a rebid. Now, that procurement was officially canceled on February 20, 2015. Subsequently, the procurement was resolicited. The respondents emerged were Catamaran, PBM of Illinois, Caremark PCS Health LLC, and Express Scripts, Inc. The result of that procurement was a contract award to Caremark PCS. In that procurement, there was one disqualification, and that was to Express Scripts. I can provide additional details about the nature of how each of these events occurred, but that's the basic timeline for the events. And as the director said, implementation and transition from our current vendor to the new awarded vendor is in discussion and underway now.
Can you sort of elaborate on what was the reason for the disqualifications in the first bid for you to redo the whole process?
So the first disqualifications were all administrative deficiencies that were not curable, either not appropriately registered with the Secretary of State, not appropriately including BEP requirements for the state, the other administrative requirements, and I can supply to the committee, if you like, documents for those. But the others include the registration with the State Board of Elections for campaign contributions. Those are the administrative criteria that we're challenged with for each and every vendor. In this case, all three vendors needed to go back and remedy those things in order to become responsive. It was in the best interest of the state to resolicit at that time.
Okay.
And the subsequent procurement, Express Scripts was the only vendor who was removed. They had to meet BEP requirements, which they did not meet. They relied on a subcontractor whose registration with the BEP program had lapsed. And so as a result of that lapse, this is a non-curable event, and they were not allowed to proceed to evaluation.
I'm going to go to questions to some of the members, but can you tell me what is the definition of non-curable?
Right. So in the state's procurement code and other laws, the procurement code being primary, which is where we get the concept of non-curable, there are mandates that must be met at a certain point in time. So the non-curable events for the state of Illinois' bidders are any events that must be fully complied with before they submit their bid to the state of Illinois. Once we have a bid in hand, that information gets locked down. So if there's any deficiency or if there's anything, like in the case of ESI, where the vendor they proposed had a lapsed registration, there's no provision in the law for a remedy to be applied. Now, there are other things that are curable. So once you get past bid, we look into the bid and say, you know, is this a typographical error? Is this something that the vendor is allowed to continue to do or improve while the bid is being evaluated? But specifically, those non-curable events are all statutorily required to have been met prior to submitting a bid to the state of Illinois.
And I guess one more question to that. So there, as CPO, has never been an instance that you've had some authority to make changes after the bid has been submitted?
Not in these non-curable areas. In areas that we can allow for changes afterwards, yes, but not on non-curable areas.
Okay, and they're defined in the procurement code. Are there questions from other members? Yes. Senator Roach.
Thank you. So, of these non-curable events, in the first round, all three bidders were disqualified. And who were they again?
Catamaran PBM, Caremark PCS, and Express Scripts.
So these are major national companies.
Yes.
Who would have regulatory compliant legal staffs, things of that nature?
I presume so, yes.
But they couldn't figure out how to bid successfully in Illinois under our current procurement code?
That's right.
Of those three bidders that were disqualified, and I don't know what the answer is, Matt, were any of them cheaper than the bid we took?
In that particular bid, we didn't open price. We didn't go anywhere because they were all disqualified. So that bid was
so the lowest. Taxpayers don't know whether we got the lowest price or not for what's the total price tag on this contract?
So on that bid, the prices weren't open. The subsequent bid, pricing was opened. Okay. And I can provide, of the two vendors that moved on to evaluation, the pricing information. The financial analysis for Catamaran is $3.3 billion roughly. The financial analysis for Caremark is $2.9. So obviously we awarded to the low bidder for Caremark. But in the case of ESI, their pricing was not open.
Okay, so we're talking about a roughly $3 billion contract, and I can't go back to my taxpayers and say to them, we know we got the lowest bid. Is that a factual statement?
We know we got the lowest bid in the scenario where we were able to proceed. And I know, Senator,
of qualified bidders.
Of qualified bidders.
But we don't know that we got the best deal.
We got the best deal under the laws of the state that we operate under.
Ma'am, meet me halfway here, man. Just say it. Just say we didn't get the best. We don't know whether we got the best deal.
Absolutely, we don't know. Senator, and I'll be straight with everybody on this committee. We would have compromised the state's decision-making ability had we peaked at that disqualified vendor's price. And it's, this is not unusual by state of Illinois standards compared to other jurisdictions. It is a procurement norm to not peak at the price of disqualified vendors because it creates an opportunity for decision makers to potentially be unduly influenced or to second guess. Now we do have a responsibility to look at the prices we do have, use every tool we have other than peaking at the disqualified price to try to determine if we're getting the best deal. And if we feel that we're not, then we have to go back to the drawing board and take another shot at it to get that best price.
No, and I understand that you can't peak. I mean, I get that point. But what I'm suggesting here is that our procurement code needs to be reformed because you're talking about a $400 million differential between the two people that went forward on this deal, between Caremark and what was the other one? Catamaran. it could have been $400 million less from the 2.9. And, this is not aimed at you. It's aimed at everybody up here. This is yet another example of why the procurement code needs to be fixed. Because quite frankly, I'm not asking you to peak. I'm just simply pointing out disqualifying the lowest bidder because they didn't file some stupid piece of paper with the Secretary of State's office. Who cares? I mean, at a minimum, we ought to be able to give them a chance to complete that after the bid's awarded, but before the contract takes effect. That would make sense. Hey, you forgot to file your SOS or your State Board of Elections. Fill it out now that you've won the award before you actually get paid. Okay. It's not at that point an incurable problem, right? If we change the law.
I understand I understand your point, Senator. And if the committee will indulge me, one of the reasons why using that example with Secretary of State, is because the state has experienced, and it doesn't happen very often, but the state has experienced situations where people delay their appropriate corporate filings because they've been involved in some bait-and-switch scenario where they need to hide their identity because they're concerned the state will find something untoward in their background. And that's the reason why the law was written to afford that vetting process with the Secretary of State prior to bidding. Can it be relieved? Sure.
Do the consequences change?
Yes.
Give us all your previous also known
sure.
asses.
There are alternatives.
I mean, there are other ways to do this. Now, so in the three bids, the original bid that went out in November of 17, so actually let's just talk about that right there. So the original RFP went out in November 17th of 14, and then it was canceled February 20th. So that's 3 months. Then we did another one on March 4th, and when did it take effect, or when was it awarded?
That was awarded on
April sometime?
April 14th.
Okay. So 5 months' time here.
Consumes a lot of time,
which also means money.
Absolutely. It costs,
I mean,
you know,
four people up here.
It takes a lot of individuals and a lot of work to process procurements large and small. It's the nature of that responsibility to the state.
Okay. So I'll finish up here, but of the you said that of the three bidders that were originally disqualified in the initial procurement, did I hear you correct that one of them was thrown out on only a single technicality?
Yes.
What was that technicality?
I believe it was a State Board of Elections registration, but I can verify that. I mean, these are the things that we test for, and the test is considered a test for responsiveness.
Is that something? I'm putting you on the spot here, but I'm not aiming this at you, okay? Because this is a procurement code problem that we have to fix. But is that something that we could easily just say, hey, fill it out later, if we change the law?
You know, given the nature of these responsiveness tests, these non-curable things, there are several in the procurement code, and the law can certainly be changed to make that threshold show up in a different place or have different consequences. There's no doubt about that. The question is, you know, what considerations will the General Assembly want to make about that? Whether, for example, Secretary of State is about appropriate identities to prevent bait and switch. State Board of Elections requirements are about pay to play. The responsibilities in BEP, which is in our second procurement, are about doing the right thing for diverse vendors and not seeing them steamrolled with bid shopping, bid swapping, and other very bad behavior. So there are a lot of consequences tied to these laws, and I do appreciate that you're considering, you know, how to address that.
Would you say that you're concerned about filing the Secretary of State's office that maybe this was some shell corporation that suddenly appeared to hide the past doings of a previous corporation, right?
That's the purpose of the law.
Yeah. But that could be some sort of technical review period after award where that was followed up on, right? And you probably also expected at some lower threshold. I mean, at the point at which you're bidding these $3 billion contracts, the only people really bidding are pretty established big-time companies, right?
In this case, yes. And what I would say, Senator, is when you look at the decision you have to make on State Board, or excuse me, I keep misspeaking on that, on Secretary of State, is that when you're doing it during the earlier part of the evaluation, it's a pretty clear decision. Again, while it's at the front end and it's a disqualifier, you find out if they've complied with the law. If they haven't, that's a clear disqualification to make. If you move that line to the other side, where the bids have already come in, then the decision makers subject themselves to qualifying who did what and when, whether it was appropriate, whether they actually did something the right way, the wrong way, et cetera. It makes the decision much more complicated.
You could have the filing date, and then you could send them a notice back that says you've failed to meet these four procedural things.
Absolutely.
You have 1 week to file it.
It would not be difficult to rearrange the decision tree as far as that goes.
So on the note that we have a $3 billion contract and we have no idea whether the taxpayer has got the lowest bidder or not, I yield my time back. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Yunus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt, along those lines from Senator Rose, Can you explain the qualifications of the business enterprise program and what happened in the second RFP to disqualify one of the vendors?
Sure, and part of your question I would defer back to CMS and our expert Paul Serpa, but I can speak to the disqualification itself, and that is one where as we looked to the BEP program for validation of the subcontractor's registry in the program, and the law requires in order for you to receive consideration in the program you have to be appropriately registered. The BEP program confirmed that the registration had lapsed, and I believe that the BEP program had even notified the firm that their registration had lapsed and that they needed to get current if they were interested in looking for state business again. So given the fact that they were lapsed, they were not a properly registered vendor, they're not qualified under the procurement rules to receive consideration. So what that means is ESI relied on a subcontractor whose registration had lapsed, so ESI's bid, their offer to the state, was not appropriately qualified because they have to bring a ready, willing, able, qualified, and registered vendor to the table prior to bid. Once they submit the bid, they can't, you know, essentially go shop around and try to find a firm to help them meet their compliance requirements. And Paul, if you want to make some additions.
All of the contracts that are out for bid, in many instances, contain a BEP goal. And prime contractors are required to address that goal either by utilizing a BEP firm or demonstrating their good faith efforts. In this particular case, Express Scripts did identify its BEP firm, EMED, to participate in that program. That firm is a firm that was allowed entry as a BEP with the state through a recognition process. It's a much more expedited process. In short, it accepts recognitions of certifications from other entities. In this case, this firm was certified with a St. Louis entity, the Mid-States Minority Development Council. However, though, BEP's certification process accepts certifications from the City of Chicago, Cook County, CPA, METRA, PACE, Illinois Department of Transportation, and the Chicago Minority Development Council, as well as the Women's Business Development Center. Now, there's a reciprocal acceptance between the Chicago Minority Development Council and the St. Louis Mid-States process. However, in both instances of certification being authenticated, neither Chicago Minority Development Council nor Mid-States was able to verify that the firm was certified. We went back and forth to the firm, originally notifying the company that its application was to be renewed on an annual basis. That is a requirement to ensure no changes in the firm have occurred. We sent that out in November. In January 31st, that's actually the expiration date. The firm did submit its application on the 20th of January. On February 5th, we responded to the vendor. There were lacking documentation to ensure certification. We followed up as well to the firm with an email. Unfortunately, then on March 1st, the firm failed to respond on all of our requests and ultimately became denied. Therefore, at the time of its identification within the bid, the firm was not a recognized BEP firm.
Okay. Two more questions. Since you did reach the bid process on the second RFP, do we know what their bid was?
So, Representative, anytime we have a disqualified vendor who doesn't progress to the evaluation stage, we do not look at their bids. That's what I referred to earlier, so we don't peek. We don't look at their prices. We don't give them a technical evaluation. We stop their bid at that point, send them a disqualification letter, and say you're no longer proceeding in the process.
Okay. I know that you probably don't have this today, but I think it would be helpful if one of you could get us what are the qualifications for a firm becoming a qualified BEP.
I can certainly do that, but for the benefit of today's meeting, in short, the firm must be 51% owned and controlled by one of the presumptive minority groups, females or persons with disability. It must have gross revenues under $75 million, must be a lawful legal alien or citizen of the United States, and must be able to provide supporting documentation and information attesting to the fact that it owns and controls the day-to-day activities of the firm, in short.
Any requirement on number of employees?
No.
So just 51%?
51% ownership by those presumptive groups.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please add Leader Murphy to the roll and Leader Severson.
Thank you. When is this contract going to go into a place then with the with Caremark?
Could you ask a question?
When is this going to effect? When does this new contract begin?
It's been awarded. The implementation is effective July 1st.
Okay. So now, with only a short period of time left, then are you going to be communicating that to the employees, or how does that get out to everybody that this is the new vendor as of July 1?
Hi, Pam Kogler, Benefits. What we're doing is, in the Benefit Choice book this year, we did put out that we would announce on the Benefits website as soon as we could who the vendor is. We have not done that, and the reason why is because of the late timeline that we're in. The implementation, we're going to be ready to go July 1, but we don't have any phone numbers for customer service for people to call until, I just found out this morning, I had a conference call with CVS before I came here. That's going to be up and running Saturday. So Friday, we will put on our website that it's CVS starting July 1. Here's the contact information if they have calls. And then we'll update the Benefits Choice book online and have all that information included in it.
So there'll be will cards or information be able to be in individuals'
yes.
hands by July 1?
Yes. Actually, those are being – the kits and cards are being – they were produced last week. They were put in the mail. Some people, we received calls yesterday that have already got the cards. They were mailed from St. Louis, first class. So really, by the end of this week, everybody should have their card.
All right. What was the cost to have to mail everything by first class? I mean, was there a reason for the delay taking this long, and as to now why we have to expedite and spend the extra?
Well, there's no cost to us. I mean, it's all included in the contract award. So CVS is absorbing the cost. They do the kits and cards.
Okay.
They mail all of
so
that.
So they were aware of this is this an added cost? I mean, I can't imagine what first class postage for that many individuals. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in cost to have to send that out, I would think. So.
Well, there's 65,000 members who will be getting a card approximately. But that's just the cost of doing business for them, I think, and it's because of the late time frame. You know, we didn't get all of this approved. I have that May 26th was when it was fully awarded, and we couldn't really do much before that. So we have been having numerous conference calls with CVS every day to make this happen by July 1, and it will happen July 1. But that's why, you know, we had to get files from Express Scripts of who the members were, what their prescriptions were. We had to get all that transferred over. So, and we had to wait till benefit choice enrollments were done to see who all needed a card. There's a lot of things at play. It will all happen. People will have their cards before July 1. CVS is absorbing the cost of that. It's just in the contract cost.
Okay. Now the network, will the network be the same, or is there going to be a different network of who is going to be considered a preferred?
They have over 68,000 pharmacies in the network, so I'm guessing most, if not all, are probably very comparable. I don't have a network analysis showing the difference, but with 68,000, it's going to be your big chains, you know, your Walgreens, CVS, Walmart, Target, all of those, as well as independents. So there'll be plenty of places for people to get their prescriptions filled just like today.
Now, will the formularies be the same as they were in the past, or are we talking about different formularies?
It's a different formulary. Every prescription benefit manager will have their own formulary. Like Health Alliance has their own, Coventry has their own, Humana has their own, everybody has their own. They all vary slightly. And so this one is a little bit different than the ESI one as well. But that being said, any health plan also changes formularies during the year. So even though there's, you know, ESIs may have been one on July 1st, say January, they may change formularies just based on different analysis that they do. So that's just common practice.
In that bid difference between Caremark and Catamaran, which was like a $300,000 difference, I think you stated on that. Does the formulary difference, does that come into play when we look at, when you're comparing those? Do they, I mean, if two carriers have a different formulary list, that could have obviously a big bearing on rates as well, if they have certain high-priced drugs in one formulary versus another. So when you do that comparing, is it strictly dollar amounts, or do you include comparing the formularies between the two different carriers?
Nancy, I don't know if you can speak to that, but there... Okay, and the director was just reminding me that the context of this procurement was for the self-insured plans only. So these are members in HealthLink, OAP, Coventry OAP, and the Quality Care Health Plan. This isn't all the plans. So we're not talking about all the membership changing.
Right, but for those 65,000 or so,
right.
if one carrier is coming in 300,000 different than the other, but that carrier has different drugs that are in Tier 3 versus Tier 2, for example, then it's a significant cost differential. So when we compare those, did we look at just that $300,000 savings, or did we look at what drugs were going to be Tier 1, 2, or 3 versus the other carrier, and will one cause employees to have significantly higher out-of-pocket costs, thereby saving the drug company that $300,000
right.
In the end, not
sure.
Really a savings.
The disruption was very minimal between the two formulary lists. We do a comparison. There's a lot of things that went into that contract. We do, as with all of our plans, they try to drive members towards generics. About 80% of prescriptions are generic. And then you have your formulary lists that build on that. And so they were very similar to what they have already. I mean, we didn't want a big disruption in what people are going to have to change. So there's step therapies involved. There's prior authorizations involved. That's with CVS, as it was with Express Scripts. There's a lot of things in place that keep our costs low that we utilize when we're working with a PBM, a prescription benefit manager. And so those were looked at. So it wasn't because of a formulary being that, you know, way worse and a higher tier cost.
Okay, I think she's
so,
good.
I just wanted to let you know that we engaged with an actuarial firm on this procurement, and they did look at formulary disruption as it related to the pricing on this. The disruption in the network was 1%. Sorry, I'm Nancy King. I am the manager of the Benefits Management Division, Bureau of Benefits.
Okay.
So there was a 1% disruption in the actual network and a 1.8 disruption overall in the formulary. And Siegel Company is the actuary we use, and they did that financial pricing component for us on our behalf. So it was looked at.
Okay. So, but that 1.8% or, I mean, that's of 3 billion or of the other 3 billion, that's still a large number. So, will individuals will they be notified, or will they know when they get these cards then, when they go to the pharmacy and find out that, because usually the tier differential is going to be on the higher priced specialty drugs. And so if there is going to be that differential, do they know that, or do they find out when they, in July 1st, when they go to the pharmacy and find out that their particular drug now is going to be a tier 3 or a specialty drug versus a
right.
tier 2, and there'll be a significant increased cost for that individual.
Right.
But on the reverse side, someone else could be going from a 3 to a 2, or and their cost could go down.
True.
But do they probably won't know that then until they present their first prescription.
Well, yes and no. Because we knew this was going to be an issue, we're after the benefit choice period. We weren't able to have the time to know what the formulary list was going to be to put it out there for the members to access to see if their drug was changing tiers. What we're doing is we're implementing a 90-day grace period. So from July 1 through the end of September, members who would have disruption in their drug, say they're going from being a tier 2 to a tier 3 drug, or maybe they're a tier 3 now and it's going to be not covered under the formulary, we are going to cover them for 90 days at their current tier. They're also going to get a letter telling them. The letter will go out probably closer to the end of July once we have all the data in the system. The letter is going to go out to the members who are members and dependents who are affected. And it's going to say, this is the drug you're taking. It will be, changing on the formulary list. We are going to maintain you with the same copayment you're paying today until October 1st. To give you time to talk to your doctor to see if you could switch to another drug that maybe is on a lower tier on the formulary list. Or if it's a drug that's not covered, to talk to their doctor about maybe switching to another drug that is covered. So we are sending that out. We're giving them time to make that change, and we are basically honoring the same copayment because we know it's because of the late notice, and, they probably would have known had we had this done sooner.
I guess last question then, again, in tying that in with the initial question then, so they're willing, they're going to eat that cost differential, even if those copays are going to be higher for those months. They've agreed to, as part of their contract, to eat those additional costs as well.
Correct.
Until October 1?
Yeah.
And then October 1, it would switch, revert back to the
We'll go to
contracted.
Their standard formulary.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then... In closing, then, the bid that was received, we're saying is there was a 2% differential or 1.8 or 9% differential disruption from the existing provider, not the difference between the two finalists in the bidding. You're saying that disruption was from the
I think that was
provider.
The formulary list. Formulary list disruption? 1.8. So... 1.8% of the members will have a disruption. And right before this meeting, I asked them how many members that would be, members and dependents, and it's about 13,000 people who will experience some kind of disruption, change in tier, or perhaps their drug won't be covered.
And we don't know how much that disruption is going to really cost dollar-wise. We just know that many people are going to be disrupted, but we don't know dollar-wise.
Right, right. Yeah, we're going from their last prescription filled with ESI based on a file we just got. Last week, so.
So when you do your procurement, if that 1.8% disruption ends up being, $300,000 or $400,000 difference, couldn't that make the difference also on your final, when your final bid, if someone's coming in, $300,000 less, but their formulary totals, if you total those up, could have equaled that same amount?
I don't think we're talking that kind of money. I can find out more.
I just wonder when you do your procurement, if you are cross-checking those formularies to see if how big of a difference there is between the two carriers, because that could affect the bid as well.
Right, that's the 1.8 difference in the formulary, the disruption of the number of members who will have.
Yeah, those number of members. We don't know what the dollar amount of that translates to.
I don't think so, do we?
The actuarial company actually did the comparison based on information they had available to them at the time the RFP submissions were received. So is that up-to-date information?
Well, that's, you said 1.8% of the number of individuals disrupted. Was there a dollar amount to what that 1.8 represents? Do we know? Because that would be, and that's the added cost that the employees or the end users, that's the added cost the end users are going to incur by switching to this contract. And so what is that? We know the number of people that are disrupted, but do we know what the cost to them is going to be?
I do not personally know what the cost to that would be. We can go back and ask the actuarial company that reviewed the pricing on our behalf, and we can check with CVS and get a dollar amount as closely as we can.
Okay, if we could, I think that just gives an idea of whether or not how much more this is going to cost.
Well, you have that way, but as you said earlier, you could have people on higher tiers that are going to lower tiers or generic and saving us that way too.
Right. So. If there's a way to do the net, but
okay.
All right. But I appreciate your time and answer the questions.
You're welcome.
Leader Staines.
Thank you. This is probably a question more for the director, just a more broad-based question. We hear a lot. I know Senator Rose has spoken a lot about procurement challenges. I suspect that how cumbersome we are to work with on procurement may, in fact, reduce the number of people who can work with us and the number of bids we get and all that. I know we've had some conversations about the desire to try to maybe look holistically at reforming the procurement process. Just wondering, is that something, there's a lot on the agenda that may not be something you're delving into right now. I'm just wondering how that fits into the overall priority and if that's something you've been having a chance to delve into and maybe be making some recommendations for changes more holistically on the procurement process.
Yes, is the answer to the question, Senator. Again, this is Tom Terrell, Director of CMS. Ironically, this contract action was the first. I've been in here about 2 weeks or so when this happened, and I had an even more emotional and louder response than Senator Rose did. We have three of the largest companies in the world, and they can't figure out how to do business with the state of Illinois. This just doesn't make sense. So I think on balance that the CPO, in particular Matt Brown, has done a great job of introducing as much flexibility as we have been allowed into introducing common sense and good business practices into the CPO, but we still have to follow the letter of the law. And to introduce some flexibility that we thought made sense as the current statutes have matured, as you're all aware, they were put in place for specific reasons in a fairly complicated time in Illinois state history. So we're thinking now maybe we're beyond that and at a point in time where we could reconsider introducing some flexibilities that would allow us to operate in a more business friendly and logical, common sense, less administrative burdensome way. To that end, we worked with the governor's office and CMS put together some nominative language that we had submitted as potential reforms that's under review by staff. I don't think it's in legal language, but it hasn't been submitted by the legislature. So there is an initiative that exists in its early days that we'd love for you to consider that would introduce the kind of flexibilities that we'd all like to see so that we can always accomplish our fiduciary responsibility to the citizens of Illinois.
Co-Chairman Moffitt.
Thank you, Senator. And Director, thank you and your staff for being here. Appreciate it. You've shed some excellent light on this. If you said this, I've missed it. We know what the bids are now, of the two that were remaining, the $3.3 billion and the $2.9 billion. How does that compare to what we had been paying? Is there a way to establish that? In other words, did the bidding save money?
Is that an apples to apples comparison?
You need a conversion factor for apples to apples? Is that what you You know, are we going to save money? That's the bottom line. And you were required to bid it, right? I mean, it's been the old contract has been out there, and every 5 years?
It's a 10-year contract.
But that's with one-year renewals, right?
Yeah, five initial, five.
Right. So had the current one been in place?
Yes.
10 years then? Okay. So, you know, I'm just curious if we're saving any money.
Yes, Chairman, to answer your question. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Christy Conrad. I'm with Benefits Fiscal. Absolutely. Our ASC fees, our administrative service charges, will decrease by 13% overall for FY16. As far as claims experience, we would have to see those numbers transpire and actual claims as we get the data in. And we will know for sure more for actual claims data after FY16 expires of how much we've saved. We do see our trends going downwards for the pharmacy benefits piece, though.
Okay.
But certainly our ASC fees solidly will go down by 13%.
Good. I mean, that's good to hear. I needed to hear that, wanted to hear that. But see if
sure thing.
So I appreciate that. Director, I believe you said in your opening comments that the goal is to, you're trying to cut $700 million out of the cost of the whole group health insurance. Is that correct?
Correct. That's separate from
PBM. But
yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things on your radar screen.
It is, and it remains there.
Okay. Do you have knowledge of any others? And I'm glad it's been brought out here by several members how complicated, apparently, we as legislators have made the bidding and procurement process, and it needs to be looked at. Appreciate you're already on top of that. Are you aware of any other states where these are three major national companies where they were unable to qualify for bids?
I have no knowledge of that. I haven't looked at any other states.
It's unfortunate if ours are such that maybe we're the exception.
I can say that as part of my education as a new director in state government, I've discovered that we are very unique with respect to our procurement process among the other states.
Okay, well, I appreciate your approach and willingness to work with the legislature. Appreciate the specifics that it looks like some real actual savings will be occurring. So that is good news, and I thank you for your response and for being here.
Thank you, Co-Chairman. Just a few more. You said that you have submitted language to your legal department to make some substantive changes that make sense out of this. Is this issue, the BEP issue, one of those things that you have submitted that said that needs to be looked at, as well as the opportunity to be a little, have some discretion in doing things?
Senator, I'll let Paul answer the specific BP, but there are a number of things in that language relative to the administrative flexibility that was discussed earlier.
Morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Obviously, you know, the BEP or disadvantaged business enterprise or minority business enterprise is something, you know, dear to me, and certainly something I've worked with in 20 years in government. I believe yourself and I, we had some history on the IDOT projects and all of those pertaining to participation of minority-owned firms. In particular, though, the issue outstanding in the procurement process of a firm being certified at time of bid has pros and cons associated with it. Mr. Brown touched upon the issue of bid shopping that's more prevalent within the construction industry, whereby a prime contractor attempts to lean on a BEP firm, if you will, for a bid that's unreasonable after they are aware that they have become the apparent low awardee. All of that aside, however, though, is what we've done internally and becomes a policy issue now, and we're implementing that on July 1st, and that is the issue of a firm being certified originally and will remain certified until such time that it has been decertified. That's pretty consistent with some of our sister colleagues at the City of Chicago, Cook County, as well as the federal level. So it will mirror that process and prevent issues such as was the case here in the second bid here of BEP. So we think that that's, albeit not necessarily a procurement rule change, is certainly though consistent with the rule changes and reform that we're looking at in procurement to ensure that the BEP community also receives the benefits of such changes.
And I commend you again, as my colleagues have, one of you, especially Mr. Director, coming in and immediately seeing that this is a flawed system and taking some progressive type of action to try to address that. Essentially, are there any other questions from members? Is there anyone here from yes.
Thank you, Senator. Just a quick one. If someone else in the audience wanted to, I'll let them go first, but I do have one follow-up question. But I'll go right ahead with it now then. Director, at a prior meeting, we raised a question about incentivizing, getting off a little bit the subject of just pharmaceuticals, but of incentivizing healthy lifestyle, healthy living, weight control, et cetera, to lower premiums. And I believe you're looking at a pilot project. If you just make a quick statement or two, I think this is real exciting, the potential there.
With respect to our goal of taking costs out of the healthcare system for FY16, we're pretty limited by the timeline as to what we could and couldn't do. And really, it just the only viable course of action, as we testified to in a previous meeting, is to just change the ratio of how much the employer pays and how much the employee pays. However, in calendar year 16 and post FY16, we do believe that there's some real opportunities with respect to plan design that we can deploy. And using an approach that's is being spoken to now in the industry, obviously, which is outcome-based healthcare, where you're provided significant incentives for a healthy lifestyle, and it's there are things that you can do that will mitigate your cost of coverage, but you're not penalized if you don't do. So we want it to be positive and a thing that is buoyant and not punitive. But that's one of the most, I think, the most important aspects of our plan redesign that we'll go forward with that we'll bring to you for next year.
Thank you. I really appreciate your comments, and Mr. Chairman, appreciate the opportunity to visit that. I don't know when they'll be before COGFA again, but I thought the fact that they addressed it once before and they've really started looking into it, it's worth bringing up. Thank you.
Well, we'll be here in July and August, so there's plenty of time to visit with old friends going forward. That's fine, too, if there's any members with any further questioning for you, and then that's good. If you can stick around for a minute, is there anyone here from Express Scripts or Catamaran and those, and maybe we can hear your side? Oh, one more question. There was a protest, I understand. And now, do you accept protests? I understand that there was a protest by Express Scripts, but they didn't get an answer. I mean, if you actually acknowledge those, didn't get an answer until after the contract was done. So is there a protest period for any of these activities, too?
Well, yes, Senator. There are, in fact, two protest opportunities which I believe ESI took advantage of, and that is, one, they protested the disqualification and the underlying reason for the disqualification, to which we responded to them that this was not a curable event. It was something that we weren't able to accept under the requirements of the law. And then at that point, the evaluations of the procurement were continuing forward. The second opportunity to protest occurs when the public is notified that a contract awardee has been selected. That doesn't mean we've entered into a contract. It just means the state has chosen the apparent awardee as a result of the process. That then opens up a protest period by which someone can challenge the award, if you will. So two challenges, two protests. One, a challenge to the circumstances for the disqualification. Second, a challenge that the award had occurred, and that the rationale for that, again, was, hey, we believe our disqualification was inappropriate. We wish we had consideration before the state, and that's the purpose of our protest. In each of those events, the chief procurement officer responds with either an approval or of a denial of that protest, and in both of these situations, those protests were denied.
Is there a window for those protests? So is it a 10-day period in which you receive the protest and you have to respond?
Yes, or absolutely. There, and in fact, contract execution is stayed. So, you know, when a contract award happens and that protest period opens up, even if it were something that could be acted on swiftly, that contract can't be executed until that protest period expires, and that's a 14-day window. So there was, and in all cases, are not executed contracts until the protest period has been allowed to carry itself forward.
Okay. Thank you all. And if you can stick around, there are some individuals, I understand, some former bidders or bidders for these contracts, if they can come forward. Good morning. Nope, just you.
I'm the only one. Good morning. I'm Mark Wormis. I'm Vice President and General Manager for Public Sector Accounts for Express Scripts.
Okay. Can you sort of tell us what happened in your recollection in this process?
We've been providing services to the state for the past 10 years, approximately 10 years or so, and we have been utilizing the BEP vendor that we have, EMED, and they are currently still being utilized. They were being utilized throughout this entire process when apparently they were not a certified vendor. But we have continued to provide service throughout this whole thing. In good faith, we responded to both the first and the second RFP. We're very disappointed that our offers to the state were not evaluated by the committee. We were dismayed to find out that the BEP vendor, who signed an affidavit saying he was still an accredited vendor with us, lost his accreditation, a fact that we had no knowledge of.
Do you know why he lost his accreditation? Just the filing of paperwork?
My understanding, it was the filing of the paperwork.
Okay.
I also find it somewhat interesting that this vendor was providing services to the state at the time under our contract, but we got no notice that he was no longer a valid vendor under the enforced contract.
Under the existing contract?
Yes.
The one that you had. So was there any kind of recourse or so how did that play out besides being disqualified? What actions did you take?
We worked with him. Tried to get him recertified as quickly as possible. We filed our motion for reconsideration, and we were turned down.
Is that part of that certification or getting requalified? Is that a long, arduous process as well? Is that something else that needs to be changed?
No, I don't think it was a long. I'm sorry to.
No, let you finish.
It was not a long and arduous process. He was certified by, as you mentioned, the St. Louis Council. He was also certified and continued to be certified by the state of Indiana. It was a matter of Indiana letting Chicago know that he was still certified there, and it went through within a matter of a couple of weeks.
Okay. So that's normal reciprocity procedures that we have with other states.
Correct.
So it should not have been a deterrent as far as adding up to the overall disqualifications.
We believe that the routine recertification of a minority vendor should not be cause for us to be disqualified under the terms of this contract, particularly since he was an already enforced minority vendor providing services to the state.
Okay. In the process, how difficult was it for you to have a business conversation with the department to get that done? Do you believe that everything was done by the book or it was ignored?
I believe that it was done by the book as it was written. However, this is the only state that we have ever been disqualified in, that we could not bid in. I'm responsible for every state across the country. We have approximately 33 different state accounts, 250 plus different municipal accounts everywhere across the country, and we spend an awful lot of time and effort to stay qualified under all the various rules, and it was dismaying to find out that we were, first of all, disqualified in the first procurement process due to a paper not being on file at the Secretary of State's office, and then in the second procurement to be kicked out entirely. So that was the difficult part.
Okay.
Because we're the nation's largest vendor. We provide services to 90 million people.
And for how long have you been doing that, or how long has this corporation existed?
Express Scripts has been in business since the early 80s. Predecessor companies have been in business since the 60s. I personally have been in the PBM business for 25 years.
And knowing now the results of the contract and of the bidder, are you at privy to share with us, did you have a lower bid? What was the price difference?
I think from the numbers that I have seen, I would say our bid was very competitive with the other bids that you have out there. And the numbers that you have talked about here, a 13% reduction in ASC cost or whatever. I didn't hear a number on the claim side, but I think we would have been right in the ballpark with the other vendors.
Okay, and what is that dollar amount?
This is $3.3 billion, $2.9 billion. I think we're going to be right around
13%, so.
Pardon?
So we're talking about a lot of money.
Well, the 13% was the savings on the administrative fees only, not the drug claim fees. There's two components to it.
On the drug side, what?
I think on the drug side, we would have been in the $3 billion, maybe $2.9 billion range overall. Right with the other vendors. I think it would have been an interesting comparison of the three. I also find it quite interesting that the state does not allow for a best and final offer, or did not, in this particular case, ask for a best and final offer.
Do you know them of doing that before?
I don't know whether the state of Illinois has done it before. I can tell you that virtually every other state does it every time.
Recommendations?
I would say that anything that the state can do to enable more people to bid on your program would be in the state's best interest. You had three vendors bid. I have seen other state programs where they have had 8-10 different pharmacy benefit management vendors bid. And so consequently, you get a much more competitive bid process that comes out of that. And I think that after this last exercise, where it seemed like that to us, rather than making certain our bids were compliant, you were looking for ways to disqualify vendors. And I don't think that's a good business way of doing business. That's just my own personal perspective. I don't want to put that down as an Express Scripts perspective. But I know the difficulties the state's in. You would want to get every vendor you can competing on your bids.
All right. Well, I just wrote it down that you said it. How do you spell your name?
Sure. WERMES. It's a pretty unique name.
Okay. Any other questions from members or comments? Co-Chairman Moffitt.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for being here. You specifically addressed one of the questions I had, if any other states had disqualified any of these companies, and you've answered that. I would just also say I think CMS director is as frustrated as we are and as you are. He was simply enforcing the law as it is and is certainly working with us to try to change that, but you've really brought it full front here. It needs to be changed. It needs to be practical. It needs to be realistic. And if other states are doing this, it seems like we could kind of look at maybe some of their prototypes or blueprints and follow suit. The more bidders, the better. I hope you will be back and bid again.
in that we can make changes that will make you want to come back. So thank you for being a provider, and I hope we can make those changes like you pointed out. But I think the director is just as frustrated as we are, and once he got here and saw what kind of system we had. So
Co-chair,
together we can make it better.
If it's going to be 10 years to the next bid, I'll be retired.
Don't forget the healthy lifestyle and walking.
But I certainly would hope Express Scripts will bid the next time you bid.
Thank you.
And we welcome the opportunity.
Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Taking the time. Oh, excuse me, one second. Sir.
Just one question, not for you, but more for, I guess, Matt or CMS. The best and final offer practice, is that something that we practice, or is there a reason why we don't?
In fact, we did conduct best and final. I'm not certain of the perspective that you offered, you know, that comment from, but with the vendors that we considered in the qualification process, after the qualification process occurred, we did best and final.
I'm sorry.
With the vendors who made it through the qualification stage to the evaluation process, we did, in fact, do best and final. The state has a regular practice of best and final, regardless of the type of procurement.
And Matt, while you're there, are there any precedents of us reopening a contract? In this case, it has been mentioned that this is a 10-year contract. Has there ever been a case that when we have these kinds of egregious discrepancies that we reopen a contract?
Those are business decisions that the agency is able to make at a couple points in time. They can make a decision like that early on to say, look, rebids are appropriate, we should be rebidding, and you take the total of all circumstances and figure out what's in the state's interest. Once you know those decisions have been made to award and execute contracts, then the agencies have responsibility for ongoing contract administration. And we do ask, from a procurement perspective, we ask all agencies to know their business. Is the market changing? Is something that a new procurement will afford the state of Illinois in the state's interest? If so, you should be pursuing it. You always look for due diligence measures. You always look for best foot forward from both the agency who's consuming services and the vendors who provide it. So you know, we think that's appropriate from a procurement perspective for all agencies. The question of when and how is really left up to the agency.
Thank you both. Coming up. Okay, we have a few more issues that if we could, Mr. Director, if you can come forward and possibly help us with. One is the current payment backlog that you are experiencing, we are experiencing.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just let Christy answer that, she can give you the specifics on it, but it's about 8 or 9 months and $1.3 or $4 billion.
The director has it right.
Yeah.
We're experiencing a backlog for the state employees group insurance plan of approximately 8 months right now and $1.4 billion.
Okay. Yes, questions from any of the members on are you anticipating with this crisis that we're in right now as far as trying to get our finances straight going into FY16, what do you see happening and what would be the ultimate consequences of any negative action?
Certainly. Oh, do you want to speak to that?
Just say in general that we're not able to pull the cost out that we've targeted is going to result in increasing the backlog and, more importantly, the duration of the backlog. Our understanding is, and in the vendor community, that as painful as 9 months is, 12 months represents a bit of a breaking point where they've got to reconsider a lot of things.
Certainly. I think
you know, depending on the longevity of the budget crisis that we're in currently, not having a budget, I think the short term will be fine. But of course, as you know, as it extends over a long period of time, we'll have a hardship in paying our vendors, and our backlog will extend.
Okay, who would feel the pain the most? Where would the first
fully insured
crisis hit?
Our fully insured vendors, our HMO partners, they bear the brunt. They are the biggest cost to us, the largest cost, and therefore we would delay payment to them first. Their monthly bill is approximately $90 million for the state side.
$90 million,
sir? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, you're leaning.
Just as I know you're all mostly aware of this, we have self-insured programs and insured programs. Three self-insured and four insured, I believe, is it?
That's correct.
So the insured programs would feel the brunt of it first.
Yes.
Questions from members? Co-chair, come on.
Thank you. As that timeline extends out, if it does, we hope it doesn't, but if it does, are we looking at added costs of interest?
Oh, certainly. Yes.
Any estimates on what that would be?
Any extension of, I would have to get back to you on the calculation,
okay.
Of course. I'd have to use my calculator super
quick. Right. But, I mean, there's an additional cost that
absolutely.
We don't initially talk. We talk about the inconvenience, the problem it creates for business, but also
sure
an added cost.
$90 million, 12% on $90 million.
Yeah.
For 30 days.
I think someone said a billion here and a billion there, and after a while, you're talking real money. Senator Dirksen. Thank you.
Leader Staines.
So, and I know also that there's been work that you were doing to achieve savings in the group insurance program as well. Some of it was reliant on negotiations with unions. I'm assuming that I haven't seen that those are coming to successful conclusion at this point. I'm assuming that we may not get the achieved savings that we're hoping for, and that may add to this backlog issue. Is that also at play here and likely at this point, would you say?
Yes, it will cause a problem in the backlog. I'm not sure how likely or unlikely it is. The negotiations are ongoing. We remain hopeful that we'll be able to reach agreements with all of our collective bargaining unions by the end of the week or by the end of next week. If that's not the case, then what I know for sure is that eventually we will reach agreement, and there will be some component of savings in there.
Mr. Director, thank you very much for coming in, and the rest of you who's with your team who came down this morning. We had on our agenda to talk about the migration during open enrollment. When did you explain? But there is a page in our handouts, so if members can look at those, and we can, again, discuss that at a later date. But in the interest of time, we're going to let you off the hook.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to discuss item three, discussion of future meetings relating to the facility closures. And we have staff, Ben Varner, is going to enlighten us.
Hi, I'm Ben Varner. I'm an analyst with the commission. I lead our efforts related to the State Facility Closures Act and administrating that. In your handout, there should be two handouts, this and this. Recently, on June 6th, we received two notices of closure from the executive branch, one related to the Department of Corrections with the Hardin County Work Camp in Cave in Rock, Illinois, which is far southern Illinois near Shawnee National Forest. That one has about approximately 66 employees. And then we also got a notice for the State Museum, which has 34 employees here just across the way at the State Museum. There's 34 employees there, and then there's 34 more around the state. We have sent out a request for recommendations, and they were to be sent back by July 8th and July 10th. We have received the recommendation for closure for the DNR, for the state museums. We are currently efforting to schedule a time related to try to get work around your guys' session schedules on Tuesdays. Currently, we think we're going to try to hold the hearing approximately the first week of July related to the State Museum over in the Capitol, either the Monday before or the Wednesday after a session day. Related to the Cave in the Rock site, we have to do it within 25 miles. There's a high school there. We're trying to get a cafeteria there we can use, and we're thinking a Wednesday after session, either the 15th or 22nd of July. We're going to discuss that with the co-chairs and see what the schedules are like. Currently, if you look at the timeline, we just received the State Museum's recommendation on the last Friday, the 19th, so we have to have a hearing by the 24th and then our advisory opinion by August 8th. And we are still waiting for the Department of Corrections, but once we get that, the timeline will sort of fill itself in. I think that's basically all I have to say right now. If you have any questions related to that.
Questions from the members? Thanks, Levin.
Yep.
Okay, is there any further business of... seemingly there is no further business. The meeting, the COCTRA meeting is adjourned.